Steve, I'm ready when you're ready.
Okay, give me a second here. I'm a little rusty. Mics are live.
All right, good morning, everyone. It is 10:04 a.m. on Tuesday, August 18th, 2020. This is a work session to discuss administrative rulemaking. I'm Commissioner Brian Krasius, joined by Commissioner Randy Christman and Commissioner Julie Podorcek, who is dialed in remotely, which is definitely a sign of the times. I don't have any opening comments. Commissioner Podorcek?
I do not have any opening comments either. Looking forward to a good discussion today on some proposals here.
Okay, thank you. Commissioner Christman?
Me neither, thanks.
Okay, I'm going to turn it over to legal counsel, Mr. Hsu.
Sure.
It's all yours.
Thank you, Commissioner. Now, you received two packets, one with a weights and measures proposed rulemaking, and the other one is more of a placeholder, kind of like our legislative discussion. There are a broad number of items that staff has kind of pointed out that they would are interested in discussing with you and possibly proposing some changes. A number of the items are cleanup. A number of the other items as well, though, have some pretty substantive changes that I think warrants a notable amount of discussion, specifically the light mitigation technology and the ICBM setbacks or exclusion areas, avoidance areas, or whatever path the commission would like to go forward with on that. Conrad has done a lot of work on the weights and measures, and he and I have passed this back and forth a number of times already, and I know Commissioner Krasius has already provided input on this too before we've got to this current draft. And I think at least for the weights and measures portions, it's fairly extensive. I'm going to pass this over to Conrad, and I'll let him walk us through all of that.
Appreciate it, Jack. Thank you. So beginning with the testing and safety article, this is quite extensive. It's been since, I believe, 2008, since the commission last did a rulemaking with weights and measures. Many of the things, items in here were necessary updates to as things have advanced in technology and things have improved. Additionally, we've been keeping notes of things that over the last few years that we would like to change when we get to rulemaking as well. So without further ado, I guess probably the best way to go through this would be item by item, and then commissioners, if you have any comments on items as we go through, I'd be happy to discuss them and provide any additional input or explanation or provide any other information you see fit for that. So we'll go ahead and begin unless there's any questions at this point.
I don't have any questions, but from a logistics standpoint, and it's going to take what it's going to take, but I'm thinking you and I spent almost 3 hours, two and a half-ish.
About, yes.
Yeah, and it was quality time. It was fantastic.
Very good time.
But, well, I think we just take the time we need, but just a heads up, it's going to take some time to go through this, I believe.
You know, it may be worthwhile.
So I might suggest that we break these then into two sessions and one where we go through all the other stuff and then a weights and measures session.
If Commissioner Podorcek, if I had to choose between the two, the rules package that's closer to being finished is the weights and measures, and I know Conrad has been putting work on this for about 5 or 6 months. If we had to break it into two, I'd prefer to go forward with the weights and measures today and then maybe have a subsequent hearing on the other matters so that way we could, if we need to do it separately, we could send out a notice of proposed rulemaking and set up a hearing date for the weights and measures. But, of course, that's up to the prerogative of the commission.
I'm fine with that as long as we can keep on track with the other rules for the upcoming rulemaking.
Sure. We could do that as well. We could schedule another meeting right at the end of today for a later date to hit up the other ones if you'd like, maybe even this week. If it works for the three of you.
I'd be open to that.
Okay.
In particular on the rules regarding the light mitigating technology, I think it's important for us to have thought that through and talked about it at least, and if we're going to do a roll on it, get it going before the session. So I think that's time sensitive, that one.
Okay, with that said, do we want to continue starting with weights and measures, or do we want to switch? I mean, everything's important. Nothing isn't. But from a timing standpoint, does it make more sense to cover these other items first and then hopefully still get started on weights and measures with the time we have today? Is that what I'm hearing?
If you guys think you can find some time, we probably only need an hour for the other ones. If you can find some time yet this week to do that, I would be open to, since we are close to being done and there's some, you know, I'd be open to getting the weight to measure stuff finished and moved if you guys have time yet this week to do another 1 hour session.
I could do a session almost any time tomorrow, but other than that, I am just like booked up this week.
We do have a work session.
I have an advisory committee tomorrow meeting for my, so that's why your day is completely open because I'm completely booked tomorrow.
We do have another work session later this afternoon. Do you think there's any opportunity for the commissioners to meet maybe right after that work session for a period of time?
I scheduled an appointment with a group on another issue for 3 o'clock down at their office so they didn't have to come in the Capitol.
Yeah, I have meetings from 2:30 to 3:30, but I am available after that. At 4. I don't know how long your meeting is, Randy. Is it the rest of the day, pretty much?
I could be back here by maybe just a little after 4. I was guessing that meeting would take an hour, but I think Conrad just indicated he's not available then.
Yeah, I've got an appointment.
I have a 4:30 meeting as well.
Conrad wouldn't need to be. Oh. We're talking now for the other ones, not the ones that.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Late mitigating. So.
Did you have something, Mr. Chairman?
I have a 4:30 today.
Scheduling.
Okay.
Well, we're burning time right now, so.
Yeah.
I would recommend that we go into weights and measures just because if we can finish this up, we can get started on the paperwork. Whereas we still need to finish drafting the other ones upon having the discussion.
Okay, let's roll on weights and measures, and then at the end of this meeting, we'll just have to work hard at trying to pin a time down.
Sure.
Okay.
Oh. All right. Well, what I will do is I will do my best to expedite this and go through items and spend a little time on items that are more substantive and then rather than just editorial items at that point and kind of work it that way if that works. So we'll start on page 2. These is the definitions for the rules. We added the addition of an audit trail. There's two different ways to seal a weighing or measuring device. It's either by a security seal, a physical seal, a lead wire seal, or a wire plastic seal, that type. Or it could also be sealed by an audit trail, which is a unique electronic count. So we wanted to add that to the definitions to recognize that an audit trail does exist as a legitimate seal. Quick update on item 2, automatic bulk weighing system. We added some additional language there. The original definition only stated that which weighs grain. Automatic bulk weighing systems can be used to weigh a variety of different commodities. Currently, the ones that we have in the state are implemented at grain elevators at their rail loadouts. At that for loading like 5,000-pound drafts at one after another, and to expedite the loading process is the purpose of that. If we move down to item 6, commercial weighing and measuring device, we wanted to expand this. So we've had some confusion over the last couple of years. Typically people only consider a commercial weighing measuring device as you know, if they buy something at a scale, then they're buying it by weight. But there could also be a couple other different parameters in there. So we added the additional definition of a weighing or measuring device commercially used or employed in establishing size, quantity, extent, area, or measurement of quantities, things, produce or articles for distribution or consumption, purchased, offered, or submitted for sale, hire, award, or in computing any basic charge or payment for services rendered on the basis of weight or measure. And Item B, an accessory attached to or used in connection with the commercial weighing or measuring device when such accessory is so designed or installed that operation affects the accuracy of the device. And typically that accessory is going to be a printer on a scale for printing out a weight ticket.
Just from personal experience, this is just one example of where I see this coming into being, but like in gravel and score and aggregate business, a lot of times where no scale is available, it seems, I think people just do things by the yard instead of by the ton because they don't want to go through the trouble for a kind of a low value item of having a scale. And both sides agree, you know, based on the size of a loader bucket or the size of a truck that it's going into, mm-hmm. and they buy things by the yard then instead of the ton. I think the whole point of it is to avert the need for measuring devices. But yet it's a unit of measurement, so you have some idea, did you get 3 yards or 40 yards, you know, and to determine right. a price. Now it seems like we're subverting that and making it impossible almost to have commerce without registered measuring devices.
With the addition of this definition?
Yeah, when we start going into size as well as other things we already measure.
I can understand that, Commissioner. The intent of this was not to kind of get away from the agreed upon unit in that sense. It was for the, you know, we've worked with some contracting companies out there where they put a contract in place. They're doing a project on a parking lot for, you know, a gravel parking lot. And they say, well, we're going to, you know, our contract is for X number of tons of product. But if we use more than that, we're going to charge you, you know, $50 a ton after that. Well, while the contract was not necessarily, you know, involving weights and measures because you agreed upon the amount you're going to get, once you start charging over and above for those additional charges on the contract, then we said, well, now it is jurisdictional and you're going to have to make sure you're using a certified scale for that. That was kind of the direction that I was going with that. But if we want to get nitpicky, when someone's buying a cubic yard of dirt, they should be buying a cubic yard of dirt. And that is a unit of measure. But that's not something we've been jurisdictional over in that sense.
Okay. There's something to consider. I don't know what to do about it. I guess now I'm trying to think of if there's more significant issues that would fall under this. But
okay. I've made a note to circle back to that then. Item 7, equipment repair notice tag. The only change here is we removed the last sentence. The tag defaults to rejection tag if the device is not in compliance with 60 days. Working with Jack, we still have that requirement, but definitions we don't view as an actionable item, and any action should be taken within the body of the rules, not within a definition. The definition is just supposed to be informative. So we did just relocate that into a different section of the rules. Item 8, liquid or liquefied petroleum gas, just removing the acronyms there at Jack's request. Item 9, we added the addition of medical marijuana means medical marijuana is regulated by the North Dakota Department of Health. That item should have actually been underlined. That is a brand new one, because we do have the jurisdiction over the scales at those packing facilities. So we wanted to really emphasize when we talk about medical marijuana, it is the program that is currently regulated by the Department of Health, and it doesn't imply any other item or whatever else someone wants to think of out there. So we just really wanted to nail that down. Item 10, we added the NCWM, means the National Conference on Weights and Measures. Item 12 on the next page, NTEP, we added the definition for that, means the National Conference on Weights and Measures National Type Evaluation Program, and I'll get into later why we added those two into that section there. Item 13, we're getting away from, haven't used the term not sealed in a very long time. That's very industry specific. When a consumer sees a tag on something that says not sealed, They really don't know what the meaning of that is. So we're really focusing more on non-commercial device, meaning that device is not suitable to be used in commerce. And then once again, at the very last part of 13, a device that is not sealed shall not be used in commerce. We relocated that into a portion of the rules and removed it from the information of the definitions. Item 14, we currently use quality assurance inspected, means a tag applied to a device which either passed a quality assurance test or passed the test in response to a consumer complaint. So we've added that additional one in there that we've been using for some time now. Random testing, we removed the portion of the last part of that definition under the self-certification rules, because random testing is applicable to all devices, not just the self-certification devices. And self-certification are manufacturing companies such as Cloverdale. They have employees that are able to self-certify the scales in those establishments. That's been allowable for quite some time under the rules, although we have the ability and authority to go in and observe and test those employees to make sure they're knowledgeable on what they're doing on those scales. Item 16, registered service person.
Steve, do we have a...
We have a technical problem someplace.
We have a technical problem. Do we have anyone else on the call right now, or did they drop off after we...
Yeah, we don't have anybody else on the call, but we've also lost the ability to broadcast. So give me 1 minute to figure out what's going on.
Okay. I thought we might, some were going, you know.
Do we need a new modem?
Maybe viewing weights and measures. Some, I think, were keen on the
right,
light.
Maybe looking at that.
Some of the wind changes and sighting changes. So I wasn't trying to
our modem went bad in the house yesterday.
Rank them in any way. I
no,
just
no,
thought,
that's
you know, Casey, I know why she was here. And I thought, well, it's just.
That was pretty new.
Then we got into scheduling.
And then maybe we
found out
the explanation. Typically,
I
replace
it
frequently.
Commissioner, can you hear me now?
That's okay.
Apparently not.
I can hear you loud and clear, Steve. Can you hear him?
Does the pace that I'm going at drop?
Oh, yeah, no, it's no, you're doing exactly, I think, what needs to be done, so there aren't any questions.
Commissioner Fedorchuk, can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can. It seems to be kind of spotty, though.
Let's try one more time. How about now?
Yeah.
All right, let's try to continue the meeting.
Okay. All right, commissioners, we are on item 16 on page 3, registered service person. We removed the bulk of this definition as this is the authority for a registered service person. We really relocated that to a different section of the rules and more made it an informative definition and stated an individual who for hire, award, commission, or any other payment of any kind installs, services, repairs, or reconditions a commercial weighing or measuring device and who registers with the commission. And I just want to add really quick that a lot of these additions were terms that we had taken out of Handbook 44, the National Institute of Standards and Technology Weights and Measures Handbook. And so the definition had been vetted through that. It's not something I just plucked out of thin air. And I wanted to make sure that we were being informative, but also being as consistent with some of the national standards out there as well. Item 17, rejected for repair. We kept the informative portion of the definition, means a seal applied to a device which has been inspected and tested and does not meet applicable design or tolerance requirements. We relocated the next half of that definition into a later section, which is an actionable item. A device that is registered for repair shall be modified or repaired by a registered service person within 30 days of the date it was rejected and may not be used in commerce until placed into service. Retail fuel device. This one we spent quite a bit of time on, and originally meant a commercial indicating fuel pump used to deliver fuel to individual highway vehicles in quantities of 100 gallons or less per transaction. What that definition didn't really capture is that we've got so many more different vehicles that are purchasing fuel at these devices. In addition, we now have the DEF that's offered at truck stops, and we're trying to really capture DEF is sold by the gallon, so it is something that the meters are tested and certified. And some of the trucks on the highway now purchase fuel in quantities larger than 100 gallons. So we didn't want to pigeonhole ourselves into what we define as a retail fuel device. So instead, we've changed the definition to retail fuel device means a commercial indicating fuel or fuel additive device used to deliver fuel or fuel additive used in internal combustion engines. And that was some of the information taken out of Handbook 44. And really getting down, since we've got side-by-sides that are on the highway now, you've got people, all the utility vehicles now that people are just driving on roads and licensing them with the Department of Transportation, wanted to make sure that, you know, that device they're purchasing from is still defined as a retail fuel device. Item 21, security seal means either a crimpable. I wanted to add the term in there for lead wire. You have to crimp it with actually a crimp that is registered with us. But also wanted to add into that seal a plastic and wire pressure sensitive seal or a pressure sensitive adhesive sealing sticker permanently attached to a weighing or measuring device to prevent or indicate unauthorized access to the tolerance adjusting mechanisms of that device. We do have devices out there that are designed for a pressure sensitive adhesive sticker to go on there, which either has to be removed and can't be replaced except with a new registered one, or has to be punctured to be able to access that portion of it. A security seal in and of itself is not something that's going to necessarily prevent tampering, but it's going to more indicate that tampering has occurred at that point. Let's see here. That is all the changes on page 3. Moving to page 4. Item 25, the new item 25, variance permit, means a temporary...
Question.
Yes, Commissioner?
Before you go on, sorry, I was on mute. You guys can hear me. On the security seal, I understand the need to add these other options. Is there language that could be included that would be just more less prescriptive so that as different options become available, we don't have to keep changing this?
I can take a look and see if there's any language there. Typically, these are the three options that industry uses now: is the lead wire, the plastic, pressure sensitive, and then the adhesive sticker. The fourth option at this point that's been added now is that audit trail that we discussed at the beginning. So that's what we're seeing a lot more. Industry devices go to is that electronic audit trail, which would be an indicator of how many times that device has been calibrated. So you record the number on the test report, you come back and you can check that number against the test report.
Yeah,
but
I'm just thinking some sort of general language that would allow adaptability over time and not require future changes, but just a thought.
Okay, no, I appreciate it, Commissioner, and I can talk with Jack and see if we might be able to come up with something, and that's a good point. Obviously, our goal is not to create something we continually have to come back to and update as industry changes, so thank you.
Yeah.
Item 25, the new item 25 on page 4, the variance permit, we simply removed the portion of that definition that talks about the economic hardship, a site restriction requiring modification of the design or installation of a device or a special installation or operational condition to be determined by the commission on a case-by-case basis. We simply moved that portion to the variance permit section and just kept the informative portion of the definition. A variance is simply a temporary permanent suspension of a particular rule granted to an owner or operator of a commercial weighing or measuring device. The reasons for that would be highlighted within the actual rule portion itself. And item 26, weights and measures inspector, means a commission employee. previously said in the testing and safety division. I wanted to strike that. So as the program has moved about within the commission, I no longer want to have to ensure that we always update that if it does change again. But simply means a commission employee engaged in enforcing provisions of North Dakota Century Code Title 64 and North Dakota Administrative Code Article 69-10. So as you alluded to, Commissioner Fedorchak, making it a little more generalized. Any questions on the definitions? Okay, we'll keep running through. 69-10-01, we'll start on 02, installation by other than a registered service person. We removed the section in here that just discusses as allowed by section 69-10-04-02.1. It doesn't remove the ability or the allowance that we've created within that section, but if we do, you know, if those sections change, this is something Jack recommended, that we just remove those portions that reference an additional section, which is yet another requirement to keep up with as we do rulemaking or move forward with that. Certification under 02.1, we added or a registered service company. The commission or a registered service company may certify devices at the location of intended uses. That was simply an update. That rule hadn't been updated since 1998, and that's back when the commission did all of the certifications, and a registered service company was simply there to repair, place a device into service, but the commission would actually come behind and certify the device. So before we allowed service companies to do that. So we wanted to update that to indicate that's how we're operating now, presently. Moving on to page 5, we have device recertification. Just changed the title to be a little bit more informative about what the section references. And the commissioner registered service person may inspect, test, and calibrate a commercial weighing or measuring device annually. The owner of any commercial weighing or measuring device is responsible for its accuracy and must have it tested once every 15 months. We removed the section that discusses commission staff shall issue a written compliance order to the owner operator of any commercial device that has not been tested within 15-month time limit. The compliance order must allow 30 days for the owner of the device to have it recertified by a registered service person. Failure to comply with the compliance order within 30-day time limit will cause the device to be removed from commercial service. We removed that section because of the ability for staff to keep up with issuing compliance orders on the number of devices we have with the limited amount of staff that we have here. We didn't want to pigeonhole ourselves into that situation where we're in violation of our own rules at that point. We do communicate with these owner operators and let them know when their devices are expired, but once again, they've got 15 months to get the device certified, and yet this was giving them an additional 30 days after that using the device while it's outside its certification, and we just didn't feel that that was an acceptable situation. We did add in here, due to the pandemic situation, a brief snippet, the commission may extend the 15-month certification interval up to 24 months. So rather than we did that in May of this year, where we extended the devices out that we weren't able to test and certify to an additional 24 months. 24 months is what's allowed by statute, so we're just going to the max at that. That ability.
But we'd have to take an action too.
We still would have to take an action or the commission would have to do a motion, but we kind of really had to navigate our way through a process we never did before this time, but now we have that option available here within the rules. Let's see here. Going to item 03, certifying and sealing. We really moved this down and took this section and broke it down a little bit more to make it a little bit more user-friendly. So the components of this paragraph were used and extended into the section here. So item 1, a weighing or measuring device used in commerce must be certified and sealed. A security seal must be installed where applicable to prevent or indicate unauthorized adjustments to the calibration of the device. If a security seal is unable to be installed, the device must be equipped with an audit trail. The audit trail number shall be recorded on the test report. Item 2, so this is getting into a security seal must first be registered with the commission, which is currently a requirement. If utilizing a crimpable or lead wire type, contain the year in which the security seal was applied on one side of and the initials of the registered service company certifying the device on the other side. Currently, we don't have any requirements for those lead wire seals. The seals that our inspectors, commission inspectors, use are embossed with ND for the state of North Dakota, and then on the reverse side, it's embossed with the year. We have found it to be very helpful when we go out and we're doing inspections or investigations to identify when that security seal was installed and by which company it was installed by. Because as devices change or ownerships change, new companies come in, and you may find that, well, this seal hasn't been broken in 5 or 10 years. Is the device still operating correctly? Yes, it is. So we did add some requirements in there, which does fall in line with the surrounding states as well. So this isn't anything that our neighbors aren't doing either. We added some criteria for the pressure-sensitive adhesive sticker. If utilizing a pressure-sensitive adhesive sticker, contain the name of the registered service company certifying the device and the word sealed, and a place to write the year of installation. That is currently what's being used out in the field, so this won't create any undue hardship. We just wanted to make sure that we set that standard as far as what that sticker is required to be to contain. If utilizing a plastic and wire pressure sensitive seal, contain the company's name or initials and a unique numeric serial number. Simply stated, if they're going to put the plastic on there, you can't really crimp that with a crimper. So they just need to make sure they have the company's initials or name, and then they've got to have a unique number that can be recorded and then rechecked upon a quality assurance investigation or recertification of that device. Item 3, we're talking in a certification seal. So this is, we're actually talking about the sticker that says tested and approved. That is the official seal that the device has been inspected and tested. It must contain the following information: name and telephone number of the commission or registered service company certifying the device. That is currently a requirement now. Prominently to display the words tested and approved. That's currently a requirement. And utilize pre-printed month and year indicators that are to be punched out upon device certification. That's a new requirement. What we're finding is that companies that are utilizing on their tested approved stickers, they're utilizing like a permanent marker to write the month and year certification on it, and that's just not holding up to the environment. When in a grocery store or at a deli counter, when the device is cleaned and they're using bleach or ammonia or other cleaning disinfecting chemicals on it, that permanent marker gets wiped off and you no longer know when that device was certified. So simply stated, we're just adding the requirement that they're going to use the same type of stickers that we use, which we punch out the month, we punch out the year upon certification.
And those are easily, they can get a hold of those easily?
Exactly. We place our orders about every 2 years for our stickers, and I would say 90% of the service companies are utilizing the punch-out stickers as it stands now. You just simply take a hole punch and punch out the month and year on it. It's the 10% that aren't utilizing them that we found issues with that we want to correct that problem. Item B, be made of sufficient quality material other than paper to remain readable and unaffected by the elements. The stickers we currently use and what's being used in the field are a vinyl type material, but we have seen paper ones that are used out there, and they just don't hold up through the winters and springs and stuff. And so once that sticker's removed, technically at that point that device is no longer certified and has to be retested. So we're trying to avoid issues with that. Item C, be installed externally and located so that it's clearly visible to the public using the device. This is a new requirement. We've come across many gas stations and scales out there that are being used where the sticker is installed either on the very lower portion of the fuel pump or on the side of it, nowhere where it's being clear and visible to the individual that's using the device. So we want to make sure that that requirement's been added. Item 4, registered service companies shall not use green, red, yellow, or orange certification seals. These colors are reserved for commission use. This was a new requirement, and the reason we've added that is that green is the color of our certification tags. Red is the color of our device rejected tags. We've had a service company now, since we've not had a color requirement, that has purchased their own tested and approved stickers that are red. I've got a considerable issue with that, considering we mark devices that are rejected and not suitable for commercial use with a red sticker. We can't have a tested and approved sticker being applied by a service company that's red. And so this leaves them the option, which many of them are using currently, is a white sticker. They can use whatever color on it or font or anything like that, but I really felt the need that we really need to reserve our colors because they indicate very specific things for the commission to be able to use.
What do yellow and orange mean? Do we need all four?
Yellow is our rejected for repair, yellow is our repair required. It's when a device, for whatever reason, does not meet, we'll list the certain requirements later in the rules, but it's a 60-day variance to operate that device in commerce. So they don't get shut down. We can fix that so that they can continue to operate because it doesn't affect the device's performance, but maybe the printer's not working or some other portion of it is yellow. The orange is for non-commercial devices that are out there that we utilize. So typically I've seen blue, I've seen black certification stickers by service company, as I've seen white, and all those I don't have an issue with. It's just making sure that we only use we keep them from using the colors that designate something out there and create confusion in the marketplace.
I don't need an answer now. Just think about whether we need orange. If they're non-certified, is that a color that could be available to other companies or whether we need to hold?
Okay. So. Yep, I'll make a note of that. And then item five, it is unlawful to remove or allow to be removed an official tag, certification seal, or security seal without commission approval. That's currently in the law as it stands now. I know that was a large section on that, but if there's any concerns or questions, I'm happy to answer anything on that. Nope. All right. Registration of a new or removed commercial device. This has been a rule that's been on the books since 97, and it is actually a rule that just practically is not a enforceable item. It requires companies to notify the commission within 7 days when a commercial weighing or measuring device that's been moved from its original location, if device is moved or a new device is placed in its spot, we're going to get a test report from that company indicating a new device or the test of a device. But this is something that working with Shelley has never been enforced, and quite frankly would create a huge burden on businesses and ourselves to try and keep up with this for as often as some devices are relocated. So in this case, it's one of the items that we see as extraneous. We can kind of remove that from the regulation. This is the yellow sticker, Commissioner Chrisman, I was referring to. Equipment repair notice. That's the term I couldn't remember. This is where I added the section from the definition from up above. An equipment repair notice tag defaults to a rejection seal if the device is not repaired or modified to a compliant state within 60 days. And then added an equipment repair notice tag may be used in the following circumstances. And we've got it lists a multitude of different requirements for that, such as if a device is a gas pump and how that's registering or how a scale is registering. The only portions in sub 2 that were changed there is LPG was changed to liquid petroleum gas. We did not change any additional items within this section as far as what would constitute using that equipment repair notice. On page 8, item 5, we did add this section here. This is dealing with a concept called predominance. What predominance is under Handbook 44 is that when you go to a gas station, if 51% or more of the fuel of the gas pumps tested are predominantly in favor of the owner or in favor of the customer, then they all need to be adjusted as closely as practical to zero. That issue, especially when it's in favor of the customer, should be a thought that's really left up to the station owner operator, because that's going to add to their cost of a service company out there, because the more time a service company spends on location, the larger their bill is. If we inform an owner or operator that, hey, just so you know, 75% of your fuel pumps are giving away fuel, they're still within tolerance, but they're giving away fuel, that should really be up to the owner-operator to choose to adjust that and leave that up to them. However, we wanted to make sure that if over 51% of the fuel pumps are in favor of the owner-operator, well, in that case, hey, you're going to need to make this adjustment. Your consumers are – you're making additional revenue off of that. So we tried to bring it down a little bit more to emphasize that and say when 51% or more of retail fuel devices tested – either by grade or by location, over register, meaning that the fuel pump is indicating that it dispensed more product than it really did, that's over registering, 4 cubic inches or more when using a 5-gallon test measure, or 4 cubic inches or more when using a 100-gallon prover. So we encompass both the low-flow and the high-flow fuel pumps. That's when we would affix a equipment repair notice to that and give them 60 days to have those pumps recalibrated. Recalibration is not a service that the commission offers for gas stations. We simply go in and we test the devices. I know I'm going through these rather quick and not going through all the rules. Is this effective? Does this seem appropriate? Is any confusion on this? Okay.
I'm good with it.
Okay. Sounds good. We'll move down to item at the bottom, page 8, 04.1, variance permit requests. So this gets into the variances for deviation from laws or rules for any number of reasons it can happen. The only thing we removed out of here under sub 2 is through reapplication, the economic hardship variance may be a permanent variance permit provided the applicant can show that compliance will continue to cause an economic hardship. So economic hardship means that, you know, if the approaches leading up to a truck scale are not within our code requirements and the applicant just doesn't have the money to be able to fix that, they could apply for a variance. Well, if they do an economic hardship variance, they need a plan for compliance not to exceed 5 years. That statement right there, I just thought really just kind of showed that, hey, if you can continue to show this, then you can get a permanent variance and never fix your approaches. And I just thought it was more of an incentive to kind of delay that fact. The option to make an economic hardship variance permanent is always there. I just didn't feel that it should be stated within there. That's something we can evaluate when the initial variance expires. And that's why I removed that section. Sub 3 on the top of page 9, we simply added the class. So when they apply for a variance, they need to indicate all this information. In addition, we've added the classification of the scale, meaning what type of scale that is in accordance with Handbook 44, which is either like a class 3, which are more, your smaller scales, or class 3L, indicates usually larger scales or hopper scales. And that's just helpful information for staff while we process those. Item 5 details the economic hardship variance. So we added some requirements in here that weren't originally there. Detailed information showing that compliance with specific regulations will cause economic hardship if applicable to the variance permit request and must include. So if they're going to apply for a economic hardship variance, I'd want to make sure that we're presented with all the information necessary for that. Specifically, sub A, specific details on how adhering to current laws and rules places an economic hardship on the operation. So we're really going to have to spell that out for us. Sub B, an itemized list of costs associated with adhering to current laws and rules, meaning if they're going to claim that it's going to cost them $25,000 to adhere to this, then I don't think it's out of the question for us to see a estimate that shows this is how much it's going to cost. It just shows that the business did their due diligence and says, this is why it's going to cost us. This is why it's not practical for us to do this right now. And then sub C, just any additional information requested by the commission at that point. Sub 6, we just removed any other information the operator believes may expedite the variance permit request. And that's kind of a given that if they're going to include everything that they want to include on that request. And then at the very last paragraph of this section, we simply added something we never talked about, when if somebody wants to reapply for a variance. you know, we typically get a lot of reapplications for variances after it's already expired. So we just really want to emphasize, as the owner-operator, you need to reapply for this variance prior to the expiration date. Once the variance has lapsed, then your device is no longer in compliance with that. Getting into 04.2, split-way variance permit requests. The only thing we added to this is on page 10. Split-way variances are for elevators. Typically, you see them a lot in elevators, where they may only have a 30 or 40-foot truck scale. Well, a 30, 40-foot truck scale is not going to allow for the entire vehicle to be weighed at the same time, so we've authorized them to split-way. And that's an economic hardship on the elevator to have to replace that scale and upgrade to an 80-foot scale or something like that. So this is just constitutes, you know, how they can do that. On page 10, sub 5, the only thing we added in there is that we wanted the vehicle to rest on a smooth, we emphasized smooth surface because it's very important that that vehicle is not on a surface that would cause it to roll a couple inches back and forth, because the vehicle, when you're doing split weighing, has to be in the neutral position. So you don't want that rolling one direction to the other, is for safety reasons. And then the next change we made is on sub 7. We just simply removed, through reapplication at the end of the 5-year period, the economic hardship temporary permit may be made permanent. Same reasons we removed that as stated in the previous section. All right, moving on to 05, rejected devices. This is where we added the portion from the definition. Once a weighing or measuring device has been rejected, the device may not be used in commerce. And this is from the definition from above. A device that is rejected for repair must be modified or repaired by a registered service person within 30 days of the date it was rejected. So not a new addition, just a relocation of that section. On page 11, moving on to the middle of page 11, 06.1, liquefied petroleum gas meters, simply a spelling typo from compensator to compensator. Only change there. Sub 11, on page 11, last one there, 08, assisting an inspector. Just clarifying, removed the section that said the division and specified a weights and measures inspector, because that's what we've defined as our commission inspectors. And that we no longer, at the very last sentence, we no longer tag devices not sealed. We simply seal the device as a non-commercial device. It's just a better indicator of what's actually happening. No changes to page 12. On page 13, at the top, 11, device adjustments. Simply removed state weights and just added weights and measures inspector, as the definition has said. Moving on to 13, enforcement.
Well, does that... inspectors from private service companies, weights and measures inspectors, but they're just not state weights and measures.
They are inspectors? Considered a registered service person is their official title. This simply talks about as the device adjustments. We've defined weights and measures inspector in the definition as the commission employees.
Okay.
And so that's simply the change there. But device adjustments, certainly the reason you would hire a service company is to adjust your device. So. Item 13, enforcement. We removed the section that talked about the old handbook, National Institute of Standards and Technology Handbook number 44, and simply replaced it with law and rules. There was about 3 or 4 different places within the rules where we referenced the adopted handbook, that every time we would adopt a handbook, we'd have to update those 3 or 4 different sections. So As something to generalize it and make it easier, we simply just stated law and rules, and then that's going to be applicable for the one section we need to update when we adopt a new handbook. On page 14, at the top, we have item 15, devices removed from service. We simply stated... we removed the when a state weights and measures inspector, registered service person, removes a commercial weighing or measuring device, since it's applicable to both. When a commercial weighing or measuring device is removed from service, a weights and measures inspector shall affix a non-commercial device seal to the device. A device that is sealed as non-commercial shall not be used in commerce. A registered service person shall notify the commission in writing within 7 working days when a device is removed from commercial service. We have the ability to affix the non-commercial device seals to the device. So in that case, a service person would let us know, and we would simply go out to that location and affix the seal to it. That is it for 01. If we are ready, we can begin Chapter 69-1002. And so we'll begin on page 16. There's no changes to the previous rules that covered livestock scales. And we're saying under the only update we made to 02.1 in the middle of the page, livestock scale certification, is we removed the certification requirement for a state weights and measures inspector, since we no longer certify heavy scale devices. We simply provide quality assurance on those devices. So we're stating the scales shall be certified by a registered service person, because that's truly the only option at this point. Page 17, starting on 05.1, fixed pitless foundation scales, foundations. This looks like a lot of changes, but what it truly allowed is that many of our variance requests were for what's called a floating slab foundation. Prior to this, the rules only allowed for a pit foundation or a fixed pitless foundation that had piers, concrete piers, that went into the ground a certain distance. And so we added the ability, and we've been granting variances for the last number of years for concrete floating slab foundations. It's been authorized since before I was with the commission, and the intention was always to add it to the rules once we did a rulemaking. So that's at the point we're at right now. So the paragraph above has been broken down below here. We'll talk a fixed pitless scale foundation may be either a pier foundation or floating slab foundation and installed as follows. So originally we talk about our pier foundation. Maintain at least 10 inches of clearance between the I-beam and the slab along the entire length and width of the scale. The 10 inches...
Hey, Conrad.
Yes, Commissioner.
Where do these prescriptions come from, the pier foundation and the concrete floating slab foundation? Where does that come from?
The pier foundation has... Those requirements have been in our rules for many, many years. The floating slab foundation... The requirements that we have been using were drafted by the Minnesota Weights and Measures Program, and we've been utilizing them in North Dakota for over 5 years now. I could ask Shelley for how long we've been using them, but we adopted them here.
Where have we had them? Like, are you pulling it from a different part of the rules? This looks like all new language, so where...
Oh, sorry. The pier foundation is coming from the paragraph that's been lined out above. We're just getting a little bit more specific on that. The floating slab foundation is coming from the floating slab foundation requirements that we've published on the commission's webpage for the last 5 years at least. So that's where we're pulling those in. So while they're new in the rules, we've been following the same floating slab foundation requirements and pier foundation requirements for many, many years now.
All right.
One thing I did want to point out, so under the pier foundation, item A, maintain at least 10 inches. We've adjusted that. That used to say 12 inches, and we've adjusted it to say 10. Part of this rationale is there is a lot of scales that were installed about 3 years ago that did not meet the 12-inch requirement, and so we have a lot of variances out there for 10 inches. It's always been the understanding from the commission going through the years is to minimize the number of variances or deviations we have to the laws and rules. I've spoken with service companies about the 10-inch requirement. The idea of that is for the ability for a technician to get under the scale or to clear out debris from under the scale so that it doesn't impact the ability of the scale to weigh. It seems like the conversations I've had with service companies, that adjustment from a 12 inches to 10 inches along the entire length and width of the scale is not going to be an issue. So I did want to highlight that that is one kind of change that the service companies may discuss or some may have an issue with. The piers have piers that extend below the frost line. That has always been a requirement. Be installed to manufacturer's specifications to support the device, prevent shifting, and provide protection from the environment. That has always been a requirement from the above paragraph. Include a reinforced concrete washout slab, minimum 4 inches thick, poured underneath the entire length and width of the scale. That's been a requirement, but not as specific. The rule had always referenced a slab, but never really talked about it. The washout slab, when you've got a scale that's supported on piers, is there to prevent dirt from being eroded from the pier foundations of the scale, which could compromise the integrity of it. So we worked with that and wanted to make sure we specify that. The expectation is they're going to be poured with a washout slab, but we never have defined the specifics of that prior to this. And then we haven't stated it before, but it was always generally understood, but I wanted to make sure it was emphasized that it's going to be installed to ensure that surface water will drain away from the scale area and, once again, not compromise any of the foundations. Concrete floating...
Conrad, is the frost line a real definable line? I don't know exactly what that means, and would we be better off stating a number of inches or something like that?
We've not had... From my particular experience, we've not had any issue with anybody kind of questioning the frost line, as that can really vary at different points throughout the state.
Yeah, so if we don't think it's deep enough and they say, well, the frost line is less than that here, what do we do about it? So should we just have a measurement?
We could. I'd have to do some research to find out what might be the best depth for that. And ultimately, we would know after the scale is constructed if the scale is heaving or binding at that point, and then we would know we don't have a very good installation on that device. From what I understand, and I'm not an engineer myself, but frost line is an engineering term, which they understand at different portions of the state, different soil types. Maybe that's something I can talk to the reclamation crew about as far as getting a better understanding of, like, how is that frost line defined.
I don't have strong feelings about it, but just a thought.
I'm opposed to frost and opposed to winter.
Commissioner Fedorchuk?
Should it be this prescriptive in our rules, or is there a way to... Because how would we enforce all of this? I just have concerns about being so prescriptive in our rules to the, you know, very specific inches of concrete being poured, et cetera. I don't know, maybe that's the way this has to be done, but it seems like we could reference standards or something else that doesn't require all of requirements in the rule. But
Conrad, this is aligned with Handbook 44, correct?
There are portions of this that are aligned for it, but there are portions of this that are specific, because Handbook 44 is a national document, and so we do need to have some specifics in for North Dakota. And Commissioner Fedorchuk, I do understand, you know, not wanting to be as prescriptive, but at the end of the day, the ultimate goal is to make sure that the scale, which is being bid by a service company or a construction company to install, is being installed, that these standards have been proven in North Dakota for many, many years now, that this will ensure that you have a scale of good quality, of sound quality, that is going to accurately weigh the grain that's being sold or the coal or any other number of commodities that are going to be weighed on a truck scale. And so the concern, if not being prescriptive, is you're going to have kind of some fly-by-night operators where potentially that business is not getting a quality scale that's going to yield problems down the road, which will ultimately yield inaccurate weights for whoever's utilizing that device. And so that would be my thoughts on that. I'm certainly can entertain kind of looking at it and seeing if there's something we can just reference a little bit more. But, you know, many of this has been proven, and, you know, we've established that kind of in that above paragraph as well, that this is what works for these requirements within North Dakota. But
all right.
Definitely not opposed. If you'd like me to, I can look into, is there a way we can make this a little easier?
I just throw it out there as a kind of a broad thought.
Okay.
You know,
if everybody else is comfortable going this way, I actually defer to the portfolio holder.
Yeah, I agree with not being too prescriptive when we don't have to. This is a very specific area, though, weights and measures. You know, in other areas, I would be fully on board, no, in terms of not being terribly or as prescriptive. I like this. I know it gets very detailed, but I think there also it also creates the protections for users, both consumers, commercial entities, et cetera.
Right. I would also add to this as well that the – you know, and this is, you know, I don't like to always say, well, this is what other states are doing, but companies that operate in other states, you know, we're contacted as far as, okay, what are your requirements for installing a scale? They anticipate it. The companies that do this type of work, they know that the requirements are there. And so they reach ahead, they call ahead to find out what is North Dakota's specific requirements, because they know they may differ from South Dakota or Minnesota. So the companies that do operate within this realm and install the devices, bid them out, service them, you know, this is their world, and they understand that the specifics that are involved with it. So it's not something that's new on them, or they're going to be shocked by seeing what we have here. We'll move on to sub 2, a concrete floating slab foundation. As I said, the requirements we've listed here are the exact requirements we've been issuing variances on for at least the last 5 years, are the exact ones we've published on our webpage as well. Once again, we've got, except for this portion, maintain at least 10 inches of clearance between the I-beam and the slab along the entire length and width of the scale. That previously was 12. We're downgrading to 10. Be constructed on a soil that has a uniform natural or engineered soil bearing of at least 1,500 pounds per square foot. Be supported on a monolithic steel-reinforced concrete slab a minimum of 12 inches thick, poured on top of a base of uniform compacted permeable aggregate at least 24 inches deep. Be installed to manufacturer's specification to support the device, prevent shifting, and provide protection from the environment. And be installed with the top surface of the foundation slab above the surrounding grade level so that water will flow away from the foundation and away from the permeable aggregate base that supports the foundation. And Commissioner Fedorchuk, I know if you didn't think the first one was a lot prescriptive, I know this one seems to get into it a lot more. And these were requirements that we did grab from Minnesota with their engineering team that are currently used within that state and have worked on these floating slab foundations, because the scale is so large and you're weighing upwards of, you know, potentially 120,000 or 150,000 pounds. We need to be specific on how that's got to be constructed to be able to withstand the environment and elements we have here.
I would feel more comfortable with, you know, not feeling like this is overly prescriptive if we weren't using Minnesota as an example. Seems to me that might be the example of over-prescriptive in many cases. I don't know. I mean, I have no idea if this is reasonable or excessive or what.
I can say I'm not an engineer. I do know we've been using these requirements for the last 5 years. And when we do a re-evaluation of that scale a year down the road, 2 years, and 3 years down the road, we find that it's worked, and the foundation has not been upset, and the scale operates as it should without binding or weighing inaccurately.
Have you ever had complaints about, and they haven't seen these, changes, but with the existing package, did you get pushback from scale operators that it was too onerous or
no.
too intensive in terms of how they're written?
I have not gotten any pushback on this. In fact, the service companies that we hold accountable to these, along with the owner operators, are happy to see that they're going to be in the rules, so now they do not have to go through the extra step of applying for a variance that they know that we've been granting. But because it wasn't in the rules, we still had to go through the variance process. But I've not received any pushback or feedback that this is too prescriptive and unrealistic as requirements.
When you say that we've been doing this for 5 years, looking at the language, it looks to me like all we're eliminating is that it must prevent shifting and provide protection from the environment, not all this detail. So in what way have we been requiring this for years?
The rule originally was written just for the fixed pitless scales, so the ones that are on a pier foundation. The section that covers the floating slab foundation, meaning there's no piers that extend below the frost line, but it's simply just a monolithic piece of concrete to support the scale, that we've been going through and using through the variance process where they can apply for that type of foundation to be acceptable. And that's what I meant, we've been doing that for years. The ultimate goal, since we've been seeing that type of foundation has been working and has been successful over the last few years, was to add that type of foundation to the rules so that they no longer have to go through the additional process of applying for the variance, and that takes the staff time. I apologize for the confusion on that.
I just want to point out that it's also worth considering that by putting this through the rulemaking process, we'll have the opportunity to have the stakeholders who are interested and who may feel us more restrictive, and they'll have the opportunity to really tell us if things are too restrictive as opposed to running it through in these variance process.
They'll have a better understanding and more of a voice through the rulemaking process than when we were doing the variances.
Jack, you bring up a good point there, and I'm thinking, this has gone pretty efficiently, so I'm fine continuing this way, but I'm also fine recognizing that we have limited time this week and a timeline to meet on the rules package in general, and knowing that the portfolio holder went through this in detail with Conrad, I'd be willing to entertain any suggestions from the portfolio holder as to what remaining items might need kind of our careful consideration and what others are more housekeeping type of thing or might be matters that are best left to industry to highlight as concerns. So I just offer that as a potential pathway forward to address this rule package as well as the other ones that we have on the plate today. So Brian, were there things that when you went through it with Conrad that you really thought were kind of controversial that we might need to all weigh in on?
No, I don't think there were things that were controversial. I think a lot of it was wording, consistency in a few instances, mm-hmm. just in terms of how the language was written. I don't have those particular notes with me. Do you just want to do that?
Hit the highlights.
Let's do that.
Okay.
Randy,
I don't know, Randy, maybe you want to go through line by line.
No, I'd be okay
like
with...
We have that many concerns that are coming to mind,
right.
We've already been talking about it for an hour, so...
And Commissioner Fedorchuk and other commissioners, I'm willing to offer, too, as well. I can certainly go through. I can kind of hit the big things that we added rather than just small wording changes. And then, and just make sure a level of transparency is offered to the three of you as well, that I'm willing to sit down at your request as well and to just kind of go through any other questions you have or any other thoughts, individually as well, so that I make sure that, any concerns or thoughts you may have, we can certainly address those as well.
I'm willing to have you fly at a little higher elevation.
Okay.
On these.
And I can already say, as we're going through this, we still have to do one last final review even before it goes through the process, and there are going to be an additional edits after we go through the rulemaking process. I mean, even as we've gone through this, I found a couple of minor editing things that we need to probably just kind of clean up. So you'll have the opportunity prior to the notice of the proposed rulemaking to also provide some additional feedback as well if there are any concerns.
Okay, with that, I will kind of fly a little bit higher through this and kind of hit some of the highlights. And then once again, if you have any questions or would like an individual session, I'm more than willing to sit down as well with that. So with that being said, let's move to page 20 here. We've got 6910.02.12, observation windows, video cameras, or photoelectric eyes. We broke this section down. This just talks about more for a truck scale and the ability for the operator to be able to view the truck that's being weighed. To ensure that they can see, you need to see through a combination of windows or video cameras, the front, the back, and one side of the vehicle being weighed to ensure that it's fully and completely on the scale. Item sub 3 was added to this section. Photoelectric eyes are becoming an industry trend where you're finding them on devices that no operator is currently at an unattended scale. It's called like a paid away. There's companies that are offering that where they've got a little payment kiosk where you can pull your vehicle on and get it weighed and get an official ticket issued from that. So the photoelectric eyes would be in place to ensure that vehicle is completely on the scale or off the scale to ensure an accurate weight is being recorded at that point. So we wanted to allow for the option of that being in place. Let's see here. Well, let's move to let's go to page 24. This is a new addition that deals with the medical marijuana program. Very bottom of 24, 27 medical requirements. And this is just setting some specific parameters for the type of scales that need to be used in that industry, given how sensitive they need to be. Scales used in the packing and sale of medical marijuana in quantities of 1 ounce or less shall be an NTEP Class 1 or Class 2 scale with a scale verification division of 0.01 grams or less. And that is just simply setting and establishing that requirement for that industry to make sure that they've got the appropriate scale to use there. And that's assistance we can offer them when they're doing scale selection, and they can also take a look. Class 1 or Class 2 refers to the type of scale and how sensitive it is. The lower that number, the more sensitive the scale is. And the verification division is simply how many decimal points are going out on that type of scale. So I did want to highlight that is an additional one there.
Right. On that one in particular, I think we worked on some of the language tweaks.
And that's where we added the definition in the section of what medical marijuana is.
Right.
So that we're specific that medical marijuana refers to the program that's regulated by the North Dakota Department of Health.
Right. And everyone's good with that?
I know it's controversial.
That one we did get very detailed just so there wasn't confusion on what we would or wouldn't be weighing or testing. I mean.
Correct. And currently there are only still two.
Let me redefine that. What we would or would not be scale testing.
Okay.
Makes sense.
All right.
We'll hear from industry.
Moving into standards, dash 6910.03, I just want to point out, bottom of page 25, this is the adoption of Handbook 44. And we are moving from the 1999 edition into the currently published 2020 edition of Handbook 44. And so that's a big change for us. The subsequent changes on top of page 26 are dealing with the sections that are applicable in North Dakota. There's some things in there, such as water meters, that Handbook 44 identifies, which we do not adopt that because we don't have jurisdiction over the water meters. So that was a big portion for this rulemaking. Another big portion in the middle of 26 is NTEP requirements. The National Type Evaluation Program is administered by the National Conference on Weights and Measures. It's a program that's funded and designed to test devices that scale manufacturers are putting out to ensure that they meet Handbook 44 requirements. It's been in use for many, many years. North Dakota is one of three states that has not adopted NTEP requirements, and what I'm proposing through this rulemaking is that North Dakota will require scales to be that are installed after the publication of these rules to be an NTEP required scale, which means that it has had gone through this evaluation program to ensure that it's a quality scale, it functions properly, it operates properly, its tolerances, it maintains its tolerances and its integrity for security and not being able to be adjusted without following the correct adjustment procedures are in place. It's designed to also help ensure that people are purchasing reputable scales out there and that the business is getting a good scale and designed for what they're using it for. We have talked to industry about this. The service companies do not see an issue with this. Many of them already provide NTEP certified scales. And so it seems a logical way for us to move forward. And additionally, it provides another tool in our inspector's toolbox when they're going out and they're inspecting new devices. Now, this ensures this rule we also added ensures that the devices already in use are allowed to continue to be used in commerce. And so we added here is NTEP certification is required for the sale, installation, operation, and certification of a commercial weighing and measuring device. A commercial weighing and measuring device used in commerce prior to, which would be the date of this publication, is exempt from NTEP requirements provided the device is certified in accordance with Section 6910.0102.3. Meaning that if that device is annually certified, it can continue to operate. If that device is not certified for a period of greater than 1 year, then it loses all its grandfathering ability and would have to then subsequently be replaced if it does. So that is one big change there. These next sections simply adopt the NIST handbooks that cover these different types of our standards, our weights we use to certify devices, in addition to different measuring standards. As these handbooks have been updated, just like Handbook 44, we're updating our handbooks in here from a 97 to a 2010 edition or the latest publication of those handbooks. And that's simply on what was done on 27, 28. On page 29, this is a change from what we've done before. When we talk about standards, the standards refer to the weights or the measuring devices that are used to certify a commercial device. Previously, we required devices to be certified annually by a NIST traceable metrology lab. What we're proposing is that the certification timeframe of these standards is determined by the NIST recognized metrology lab that issued the report of calibration. However, it's not to exceed 2 years. For example, Minnesota's lab authorizes an annual certification certificate report of calibration. Montana's state lab gives a 2-year certification. For companies that took their standards into Montana, they get a 2-year certificate, although our rules only allowed us to recognize that annually. The difficulty for those companies was that when it would be due for their annual certification, we would talk to them and say, hey, you got to get your standards certified. They would contact the Montana lab. The Montana lab would refuse to certify their standards because they said, we issued you a 2-year certification. For us, your standards are still good for 2 years. Then they would have to either go down to South Dakota or into Wyoming to get their standards certified. So the fact that we don't have a lab in North Dakota, I didn't feel it was fair that we hold everybody to the annual requirement. And then the other thing is I didn't feel it was fair that we extend everybody's certification out for 2 years because we're not operating Minnesota or South Dakota's lab that issue an annual certification. So we shouldn't just arbitrarily say that their certification is good for 2 years in North Dakota when their lab is only issuing it for 1 year. So this would help some companies that are on the western portion of the state. financially, and then just the ability to have their standards done. But I'm very interested how industry is going to look at that one right there. Let's see here. On sub 2 of that same section, volumetric graduated neck and dynamic small volume provers used to certify commercial loading rack, processing plant, or refinery meters used for petroleum-based products must be certified, traced by NIST-recognized lab once every 3 years. We simply expanded upon that since we never talked about the dynamic small volume provers, which are currently being utilized out there as well. We wanted to make sure we added that.
I think we can bounce through things like that.
Okay.
The LPG. If I'm hearing the other two, I mean, it's really what their comfort level is. And,
fair enough. So now this takes us to page 31, chapter 69-1004. Registered service persons, privileges, and responsibilities. We simply added that section removed from the definition and what their authority is within the North Dakota Century Code. Same thing with registered service companies.
You don't feel it changes any authority. It
doesn't change any authority. We just relocated that section from the definition to this section here. Application for registration and permitting of a service person. This one I do expect to potentially have some controversy, although we're opening it up to allow for additional requirements. To be a registered service person, we require that person to work for that company for a minimum of 3 months to be able to receive an annual permit. That seems to me 3 months was very arbitrary. We never had anything that defined what we expected them to do. We've had people come in and try and test where the individual had no experience with gas pumps because they worked for a company and all he worked was car washes. Because that's what they did as well. Well, to me, it doesn't seem like, why are you testing to be a service person if you've never worked on the fuel pumps or on the devices that you are actually going to be certifying? And so we had established a little bit more parameters and expectations for that.
Yeah, essentially of applicable experience.
Of applicable experience, correct, and what we expect out of that. So I will just read through this section really quickly just so that since this is an area I do expect a lot of comments on. An applicant must be employed by a currently permitted registered service company, so they've got to be employed by a company that's already permitted with us, to be eligible to be permitted as a service person. Annual application for registration as a registered service person must be submitted to the commission under the following requirements. First-time applicant or an applicant whose permit has expired more than 2 years shall A, submit a complete application for registration as a registered service person on the form prescribed by the commission. The form shall include certification the applicant is fully qualified to install, service, repair, recondition, test, and certify the device types for which permitting is being requested. Provide a history of education or work experience to show that the applicant is fully qualified to install, service, repair, recondition, test, and certify a commercial weighing and measuring device on the form provided by the commission. Applicants may only qualify to test devices for which they have met the education and work history requirements. Education and work history requirements include 1. 60 days of on-the-job training directly related to the installation, maintenance, repair, and calibration of all device types the applicant will be certifying or placing into service, or 2. Satisfactory completed a manufacturer's in-depth training course covering the installation, maintenance, repair, and calibration of each device type the applicant will be certifying or placing into service. Proof of course completion is required. Or holding a certification from another state as a registered service person for at least 60 days with authority to certify or place weighing or measuring devices into service. Proof of current certification must be provided. We simply, prior to this, required 3 months of experience. What I wanted to do is expand what's the specifics of the experience we're looking for, take that from 3 months to 60 days of OJT directly related to it, but also recognize that some companies send their employees to a manufacturer's training course. I've been to a manufacturer's training course for different things in the past. They are extremely in-depth and involved, and if somebody has attended that to work on a specific device, they've more than met that 60-day requirement and the ins and outs and knowledge on that. And so I wanted to make sure we offer that as an option. And the third one is if they're already certified in another state for at least 60 days with the authority, then we can recognize that as the experience. Now, this doesn't preclude them from the requirement to come in and test. It simply establishes and gives them different options to meet the experience requirements that we've set forth. They still do have to come in and test because we want them familiar with North Dakota laws and rules as they work in this state as opposed to other states.
Connor?
Yes, Commissioner?
Two questions on this. Why are we changing these standards, and where did your new standard come from? So what did you use as a reference for these new standards?
Number one, the reason I'm changing the standards is from my experience with service companies sending in technicians that do not have the appropriate experience necessary to test. We never outlined what our standards were. And through this testing process, they are working basically on behalf of the commission to certify these devices. And so I wanted to make sure that we have specific standards in place for them to do that. I did speak with some
So does the test not weed out the people that aren't prepared?
The test can weed out some people that aren't prepared, but if they're familiar with the handbooks and our rules, then it may not weed out the people that are not prepared for this. The other thing is if somebody isn't prepared, I'm also looking at staff time invested in this. Shelley invests a lot getting things ready for someone to come in and test. I spend time on the testing day coming down and talking with the individuals that are testing. And if somebody is not prepared to test and they're not ready to do it, then that's a lot of staff time that's been invested for someone that isn't qualified and ready to take the test. For
what's the pass-fail rate?
Okay.
I'd have to get you the pass-fail rate.
Anecdotally, do you have a...
The pass, I would say we're looking at probably people that come in and test where we've got... I'd say on the first go around, a 80 or 85% pass rate. Now that person then can come in after 10 business days with the current rules and test for that one test that they currently failed.
So
that's all they have to take.
What do you think that would raise these then from 80 to 85? Do you think it would go from 90 to 95?
I would hope that would be what we would be looking at there. And then we would also... be making sure that we're conserving, limited staff time availability for these tests as well and the time that we devote into them.
I mean, I'm not saying I don't like this. I just think we need to be careful of setting the bar too high on jobs like this that people probably can get, just be done. And I think it's probably kind of hard for people in these service companies to find qualified workers, maybe not now, but it certainly has been in the past. So I just want to make sure that we're setting reasonable standards.
No, I can understand that, and I get behind that, Commissioner. One thing that we've experienced here as well is that, our current rules allow a company to send somebody into test that hasn't met the 3-month requirement. If they pass, they get a probationary permit. But all that affords that individual to do with a probationary permit is go out and certify devices that they have to still accompany somebody that has an annual permit, as we call it, a permanent permit, to co-sign all their test reports. We'll have companies that want to send in every new hire they get, even if they don't have the training, just to see if they pass the test. And some of that we're trying to curb in the limited amount of staff time we have available. In addition to the fact that we're getting people to come in and test that have never even interacted with a gas pump, and they're supposed to test that device and certify.
Can we do this? Can we get maybe a few more pieces of information, one being the current pass-fail rate, and then as we move down just a little bit more, the testing score would be raised to 80%. So how many applicants pass with at least 75 but are below 80? In other words, how many would now not be passing if it were raised to 80? And then I think that would, for me, give a little more direction on do we need to be more prescriptive or
right?
Is that going to create issues that Commissioner Fedorchuk points out.
No, I can grab that information from the commission and provide that. One item I do want to provide as well is that sub 2 and sub 3 in that section, we never recognized any of those items prior to this. There are other states that do recognize reciprocity, you know, for experience that happens in another state. And so that was kind of the ability for us to be able to recognize some of the additional training that maybe some of these people have gone through that maybe have not worked for the company for very long, but still went through either the manufacturer's course or they've got a certification from another state, and then that can qualify. So that was also the ability to open the door a little bit more to ease some of those requirements and recognize some of the other experience that they do bring to the table.
Companies will like that, and I know a few of them have brought that up in the past, so that's good. I think it's really good.
So I did want to point out it's not all about trying to make it so stringent and tight to do this. That we're opening the door a little bit more on this. Okay, I'll bring that information back to the commission. Did you, any other comments, Commissioner Fedorchuk?
No.
Okay. And then, let's see here. After that, once somebody has a permit, there is no requirement to come in and test again. They simply just complete the renewal paperwork to renew that permit. So this is just for those initial applications, and it's not going to affect those people that currently hold their certifications. Under self-certification, just a quick update. Under sub 4, item A, this allowed the individuals that were working for a self-certifying company, such as a manufacturer, and that would be like a Cloverdale or a pipeline company, where they wouldn't have to come in and qualify as a registered service person if they met some of those requirements. And I feel that they still should qualify as a registered service person because they're performing the work and they're certifying meters. Why wouldn't they be subject to the same requirements we expect all the other service people to be subjected to? So we only have a handful, I think 5 companies that are self-certifying companies, so not a huge number there. Let's move on. As I said before, we currently issue a probationary permit to people that haven't met the months of experience requirement under current rule, and then we issue what we call an annual permit. We've changed that given the new requirements that we're proposing for our experience. A probationary permit would be more of a permit that is issued to somebody that maybe has had quality assurance failures. And so in that sense, if they've failed a certain number of inspections and don't seem to be, you know, understanding what's required out there, we could downgrade their permit to probationary, which requires a counter signature by another person within their own company that is a service person and just helps monitor the work of that person until they're brought and retrained back up. The other permits would be what we just refer to as an annual permit that they renew annually, which is the same requirements we currently have now. Let's see here. On page 36, item 06, quality assurance evaluation, just simply talks about our quality assurance evaluation, the ability for the commission to go out and evaluate these, and what we may consider when we select different devices for quality assurance evaluation, or different persons, maybe could be the results of a quality assurance test, and then. On the top of page 37, the underlined portion was added from a different section. So this is not a new requirement. We just simply replaced it because we're proposing the revoking another section. Quality assurance inspection ends when the tested device either fails a portion of the inspection or it passes the inspection. When a device fails a quality assurance inspection, the failure will be documented, the device will be rejected, and to follow quality assurance inspection will be conducted as soon as practical. When a device passes a quality assurance inspection, a weights and measures inspector shall affix a quality assurance inspected tag to the device. A quality assurance inspection does not take the place of the annual certification. Once again, it's not brand new. We relocated that from a previous section, with the exception of affixing the quality assurance tag, which we currently use now.
So it currently doesn't take the place of the annual certification? I thought that it covered it then for another year.
Well, that's where we kind of have a discrepancy there. On the heavy scale side, it was doing that. On the light duty side, it was not doing that because, and so I wanted to realign that we currently, we don't have the ability to test and approve the heavy scale devices. The legislature has only allowed that program to be a quality assurance program. And I worked with the portfolio holder on that we're going to affix a quality assurance tag to those devices, and it does not extend their certification requirement, as we've received some complaints about that in the past, where we may test one elevator's device, but we don't go across the street and test or down the road and test the other elevator's device and say, well, you just didn't get selected. It just didn't seem to be a fair way to operate in that environment.
And I think we try and avoid real busy times, right?
Yep, we do.
It would be frustrating to shut down your scale in the elevator today to have us come and do a quality assurance test, and then next week they shut it down again for the service company to come and do the annual.
Right. We do take that into account. We do look at, for example, we've been doing a lot of grain elevator stuff now and in July because we know they're going to get busy here really quick. And so that we're going to try to avoid a lot of those elevators because harvest is coming, and that's a huge busy time for them.
And this is really, I mean, we're already into harvest season now, of course, with the wheat harvest and followed by.
Yep. So we are cognizant of what their business operations are as well. Procedures for evaluating the work of registered service persons. We modified this and removed a lot of it because this is something that I felt really should be defined within the enforcement manual and how we do that. And if for whatever reason, if we see a trend out there and we want to modify that process, then we have the ability to modify it without going through a rulemaking process. Because it's simply, how do we select them and the locations of the devices and the individuals we're going to select for quality assurance devices. So we simply added procedures for evaluating work of registered service persons shall be provided in a fair and just manner. And I worked with Jack on that. And then we will define those out and list those out in our enforcement manual. But I didn't think it was something that was really fit for the rules.
Do we need to reference it as defined in the enforcement manual?
Page 37, Jack.
And this is the opposite of being prescriptive. This is...
Mm-hmm. No, that would be just the manner. That's for internal use for how we're going to make that determination.
It's just a standalone sentence slash. It's really just a standalone statement.
Right. So from the perspective of challenging the rule, they would look at this from the perspective of how we're actually carrying out our duties. Mm-hmm. That would be our job to determine and provide in this policy manual for staff the manner in which to carry that out in that fair and just manner.
So, as you suggested, Commissioner, we wanted to keep that in to show that we weren't striking out the whole thing, that we still have procedures, but they're internal to the commission. Let's see here. And that's the last, the major change to highlight there. That concludes it. It finishes it, all 39 pages. So, as I said before, I will provide the other information that was requested back to the commission and take your comments and work and take a look at those and respond back to you. If any of you want to, I'm always available and willing to sit down and go through this individually as well. I certainly want to make sure that all of you are very comfortable since this is such a large package as well.
Okay, I'm going to probably miss someone, but... there might be some more questions, but I'll just say, Conrad, thank you. Jack, I know Shelley was involved. Brian, whoever else at Pat? Not Pat.
All the inspectors.
the inspectors, for sure. So this, it was, 08, but I think maybe it's just small tweaks, but this this was a lot of work that.
Right, but a lot of work
catching up, so to speak.
We've been working on this since October of last year.
Yeah, well, thank you so much. And I didn't mean to jump in if the others had questions yet.
I think I appreciate all the hard work too, you guys, and thank you for that. And the only area where I wanted to take a closer look are on those requirements for receiving the permit or whatever. The permit to be an inspector. So otherwise, I don't have a lot of issues with the bulk of the other changes that were more keeping in line with bringing the up to speed with the manuals and just tweaking some of our language. So thank you.
Absolutely.
In the case that Conrad's able to provide this information and have these discussions with the three of you and I guess have some so that you guys have confidence in going forward, would the three of you be willing to let us put this on this next agenda? We're going to already be on a tight timeline to try to catch the January deadline, and I know that was kind of aspirational for Conrad, and not to try to put the three of you in a rush. If we have to push it back, we have to push it back too. But just to gauge interest in that, how do the three of you feel about that?
I'm just trying to think if we can wrap up the requirement thing. I think that's really the loose end at this point in time. I'd like to see the pass fail rate, and again, scores between 75% and 80%, because I think that would, in part, influence how prescriptive we need to be or how prescriptive we're not.
Sure.
I think there are a lot of instances too, though, where language is even being eliminated or condensed and more generalized. So it's and also granting reciprocity from different types of training that we may not conduct or testing. I think that's great.
So. Absolutely. I do want to add one more thing about the testing is that the tests that we currently have, I find them very difficult myself. We will be rewriting our tests once we have new rules adopted, because then we can incorporate the new handbook, but there's no point in rewriting a new test when we're going through this process right now. They are very difficult. They were written by somebody that was probably enjoyed watching people struggle through testing. So I do want to emphasize that the goal of what I want for testing is to make sure they understand the main concepts and points. They don't need to be able to find the needle in the haystack that's not necessarily going to be relevant to their situation in the field. So that'll be another component as we go through this once the rules are done, is getting into and developing testing that is more applicable to what's going on.
Okay. I'm okay with that timeline, but then if we're going to move that quickly, I want to take you back to page 8 for a question.
Certainly. Okay, I am there.
In subsection 5 there, 4 cubic inches and 47 cubic inches seem sort of arbitrary. Do they come from someplace or...?
They do. Four cubic inches and 47 cubic inches. So our current standard on gas pumps for a low flow gas pump is 6 cubic inches is the threshold that for what we call maintenance tolerance. Now there is what they call acceptance tolerance, which is half of that, and that's 3 cubic inches. So 4 cubic inches is just 1 cubic inch above maintenance tolerance, and we're working with that out of Handbook 44 and in other state standards that have used that same one there.
That we've used 4 or 3?
4. 4. 1 cubic inch above that acceptance tolerance. If they hit within the acceptance tolerance, that's your more stringent standard and your more stringent tolerance, then we wouldn't consider those to be predominantly in favor of the owner or operator.
And then the 47, that seems like it'd be a lot harder to hit.
47 simply is the and that's the same standard that we've had for the low flows. 47 is the high flow, so we're using a 100 gallon prover versus a 5 gallon prover
Yeah, and it goes up by far less than a than 20 times, so it seems like that's really fussy for something that high volume.
That actually is a, it actually gives a little bit more leeway as you get into a higher volume. You have a little bit more leeway within okay. those areas.
Okay.
And I can talk about them a little more as well if you'd like to.
Okay. I see what you're saying, though. On the surface, you're right. It's a ratio of times 20, but...
yeah. All right. So I guess that kind of wraps up the weights and measures, and thank you, Conrad. And I know we have a couple more things to kind of clean up still, I see here, but I guess...
So just next steps then in terms of getting a little more information on the pass-fail rate and whatnot, time-wise, when do you think you could have that out?
Well, I'll work with we'll work on that today and tomorrow, and hopefully I can get that out to the commissioners the Thursday, be able to provide the information to you. We've just got to see what we've got to pull up in the system on that, and then we can have that ahead of time to you.
I mean, it doesn't have to be to the tenth of a percentage point, but you know, within a margin of error, what's the percentage, and then. So if we had it on Thursday, then what, you're talking like Thursday morning or sometime on Thursday?
I would hope I'll get it early Thursday. Early Thursday.
Or end of day tomorrow? Did I misunderstand you?
If I can get it to end of day tomorrow, I will get it to you as soon as possible. But at least for Thursday, because I know the commission deadline is on Friday, midday.
So then we are going to put it on the why don't we get it on, why don't we get it scheduled and then move forward as under the assumption that we're going to have everyone's going to have what they need to say yes and
sure.
ready to make the vote. But what's the next step on the prescriptive language?
For which section?
I mean, do we want to see the results first and then make a decision based on that, which is where I'm leaning personally? Otherwise, that's still, I think, the last loose end. What's the intent? What would you like to
permit?
See? Yeah, what would you like to see?
The permit requirement? Though?
Yes.
Which section were you talking about, Brian? The permit requirement stuff?
The testing requirements where we had the conversation on it being very prescriptive. I'm just trying to give...
On how the construction of those slabs? Those ones?
No, I think the registered service person test the work experience for the registered service person permit. I
thought that was the loose end, and my question to everyone is, okay, so what do we want to do with it? Do we want something different drafted? Do we want to see the test results on, when they come out Thursday at, by end of day? And then make a decision based on that they're supported by scores or something?
What I could propose to the commission is when I do get the testing results out to the three of you, I could include the section that talks about, what staff is proposing for the new requirements. I can also include what the current rule is. At this point, since we're, if it seems a little wishy-washy and we're not ready to jump forward with that one, we can still revert to the original way it's drafted and run with that, and then maybe take that up down the road a little more if it's a little more controversial, and then that way we don't delay the process for that one. There's so many other good things in here that I'm willing to make sure we can get that nailed down appropriately where we're not being too restrictive and overburdensome. That maybe the option we do is either we can run with it here, or if a minor change, or we can just revert back to what we currently have.
Okay. Well, I think that's perfect. So then we'll see some testing numbers, some percentages, et cetera, have some data, and then also what the current language is. We can take a look, and then it's really going to be whether or not we want to circle back to that, or if it's decided that, no, it's good to plug in the way it's written.
Due to the difficulty of getting all three of the commissioners together to have another discussion, maybe I can just recommend that maybe staff will circulate that information so that all the commissioners are aware, and then Conrad could work closely with the portfolio holder on this, and we could set it on the agenda and on the day of with the agenda. If we're not comfortable with, then we can just withdraw it off and try to schedule another meeting to address it maybe on a following day during scheduling, if everyone's comfortable with that.
Okay, and we don't need to share the reasoning, but if one of the three is uncomfortable, then that's all.
Sure.
And that can be communicated, then this chunk needs to be
right and
removed, or it can be left in if we don't have any concerns.
Correct, and there's also an additional deliberative process that we're still going to be going through the rulemaking process, so minor changes will be available, and based upon what comments we receive, we also might need to make some changes as well.
Just out of curiosity, could we on the commission meeting, could we, if we need to have it on discussion, could we have it on discussion and improve this off of the admin discussion meeting? Is that possible?
Sure. Yes, we could do that.
So then we could still have a dialogue about that and say, nope, this is the way we want to go, and then we can go from there.
Yes. Usually when we need a broader discussion, a lot of times we'll schedule for a work session right after that. But, of course, that's up to the commission's discretion.
I think we might be able to at least define, though, whether or not we need another work session. If the answer is no, it's an admin discussion.
Sure.
Then we can take the vote. But at the very least, I agree with what you said, get everything else pushed through if we do want to push down that path a little more. On just the one segment.
And I'm not proposing circling back in the next 3 months. I mean, we can circle back at a later time.
Shortly after.
It's not anything that's detrimental to the program.
Right.
As it stands.
The one problem that if we did follow up on admin and try to pass a motion to push it through, we would have to probably come back with another draft if there are substantive changes. We probably wouldn't have it at hand at that point in time. But
yeah, no, it would just be a decision at that point on admin whether we accept that section of language the way it's written or if we need more work on it, and then the other draft would be without that change. But everything else as it's been adjusted and rewritten. Did I say that correctly? I think so.
I guess we probably wouldn't notice the proposed, because we wouldn't have the actual proposed rules out of full package, so we wouldn't do the notice until we have all that together. So either at that point we're going to say, let's just put it to the side and not make that change, go forward with the rest of it, or if that makes any sense.
Let's see where we land at the end on Friday after we've seen some more information.
That works.
One quick question staff had, just for the information you're looking for, Commissioner. Do you have a time frame, like the last 3 years, last 5 years, or what?
I would say use your own discretion in terms of what you think will accurately reflect. If 12 months does it, and I would almost expect it would, because that's based on present day patterning and
all right, we'll take
it. It doesn't have to be, again, detailed to the last tenth. I just want to know.
Just a good estimate.
You know, the passing, and if it's 80-85%, is the range of passing, and I think we can be more specific. Over the last 12 months, we had how many, what percentage between 75% and 80%.
Okay. Sounds good.
So, Brian, if I'm understanding you and kind of where I'm at, if you want to see what's driving the need for more restrictive rules on getting these certifications.
Yeah. Well, the goal is, right.
Permits or whatever we call them.
Right.
Because we're creating a tougher, a higher standard. Why? Are we hearing complaints that these service people are missing, the scales aren't being properly tested? What's driving our need to be more strict in our requirements? That's what I'd like to know on this section. And if you guys want to set aside, as Conrad has suggested, I'm fine trying to get an answer to that moving ahead. But if it's a bigger question, I'd rather not do it and hold that piece of the package until we have a better sense for what's driving these changes, and do that at a later date, do everything else that you worked hard on.
Okay.
Correct. And I'll throw this, because since we're gathered and we won't have the opportunity to, the three of us, talk back and forth. I liked, conceptually, I liked the changes, because I was looking at, and even going from 75% to 80%, instead of certifying people out in the field or having people in the field that, basically scored a C, a C grade type inspector out in the field, the minimum then was raised to a B grade inspector or better, you know, having A's and B's in the field instead of C's. You know, some C's, but it might be a small percentage too. But I agree, it's a topic of
conversation. Again, I'd want to know if what we're gaining by doing that, if we're seeing what our concerns are. Like, are we seeing that the test, these inspectors are doing a poor job of testing? Are we hearing complaints about it? What's driving the need to raise the bar? If there's no problem, I don't want to raise, you know, make it harder for people to get these employees out in the field.
Right. Understood.
All right.
Well, I guess I'd be curious as to what the commission feels about moving forward with the rest of the rulemaking discussion, scheduling, or just taking a quick break and continuing. I'm open to all of it. I know we have a work session at 1:30. If we want to break and even do some of this at 1, I would be open to that, and if you guys are.
I, unfortunately, am packed. I've got an appointment in a few minutes. That'll take me up till that 1:30, so I did not leave the extra time in between things today.
Well, we had
The end of the day.
We did have one person who did show up, I know specifically, to listen, and they could be doing it remotely. I don't know if we have anyone on, but we may have left them, and as well as I think another caller, with the impression that we wouldn't get to it and we'd be rescheduling.
Right. So if we did it at 1 o'clock, for example, which I know the commissioner is unavailable, we'd have to renotice it.
Right. I'm just wondering, though, if the interested parties, that the one who is here and whoever was on the phone or whoever else might just be viewing, that we don't. Yeah, you know, there likely are interested parties that are under the impression that we're not going to be covering it, and then we do cover it.
Well, I think it was just that somebody has to leave now anyways from our team.
Oh, okay, so it's a moot point, so we're going to have to reschedule that regardless, correct?
Right.
Correct.
Okay.
Did we want to reschedule it now, or would we like to?
Let's give it a go. Yeah, I think if we can land on a date, that doesn't hurt anything. So did we basically, tomorrow does not work for you, Julie, at all?
I could do it like first thing in the morning. My stuff starts at 9.
So 8 o'clock? Would an hour be enough time? Thank you, Conrad, very much.
Well, we could get a lot done in an hour. I think it's probably enough time, but we could get a lot done.
I think a lot of these are minor things, and so probably about 4/5 of them, and I think then there are probably 2 issues that really I expect a lot of discussion.
I
would propose moving the more controversial things first, take care of those, and then go back and do the smaller items.
Sure.
So 8 o'clock, Commissioner Christman, does that work for you?
That works for me.
Perfect. So to be continued at 8 o'clock tomorrow, and we're not going for the good of the order. I think Commissioner Fedorchuk has to get to another appointment. So or anything else, Jack?
No, thank you. Thank you all for your time on this.
Okay, well, thank you very, very much. Okay, we are adjourned.
Thanks, everybody.